sê, yes, what we did was to prepare a briefing document which will be handed to the committee members. We did submit that to the secretary. And just to explain to you, Mr. Chair, the introductory part of our briefing document roughly covers what will be presented to you on the PowerPoint now, but we decided yesterday afternoon to provide the committee members with background information to the development of the bill, which will assist the members. And as you pointed out, it is a PowerPoint, so if we could focus our attention to the screen, I'm going to request Ms. Ananda Loading to conduct the PowerPoint presentation for us, and then after that, hopefully, the document will be ready, and then we can proceed with the briefing on the content of the bill, Chief.
Good morning. As you said, my name is Amanda Lowe, and I think while he's just trying to fix the... wasn't fixed very securely. I will be just be giving you some overview of the bill and providing you with some context so that it will be a little bit easier to understand the specific sections that he will be dealing with once we start with the specific provisions. I'm very sorry, but we had it all fixed and now apparently it's not picking it up anymore. I'm just going to close this and open it again and see whether it will work with you. Oh, there you are. There we are. Thank you very much. There you are. Okay, so we can start things. What I'm going to do is just to look at the aims, purposes, and goals of the bill in general, and then to look at some of the key aspects in terms of compliance, because that is what people are interested in, is how is this going to work in practice? And there we will be looking at the policy commitments, legislation, and the implementation part of it. Okay, first of all, before we start with anything, I just want to address a few misconceptions that people often have insofar as this legislation is concerned. The first thing is that this bill, privacy is not, in this context, is not about the right to be left alone. It is about the right to control personal information even after disclosure to others. In the world that we live in today, in the information era, it is impossible for a person to work or do anything in the real world without providing information. You provide information at the school, at the hospital, at the church, wherever you go, you will be providing your information. That doesn't mean that you will lose control of that information. So it's not a question of not providing the information, it is actually, the whole bill is about the regulation of that information in the instances where you provide it to all of those institutions. The second thing is that privacy is an obstacle to overcome. It's a problem now, and that is not the case for
ma'am, just a moment. Hello, Matilda.
That's very important. I don't know if you would like to indicate that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, when we were struggling with the computer, I the thought crossed my mind just to provide a brief information in that regard. The Protection of State Information Bill, Mr. Chair, as the members will know, deals with the regulation and also the classification of state information. Now, that information, in other words, information held by the state, that information protection is above and beyond and in addition to personal information. That bill will replace the current Protection of Information Act, which also deals with the classification of information held by the state. And it will only be applicable to public bodies, in other words, governmental structures, government bodies. The Protection of Personal Information Bill applies to in both the public and private spheres, and it merely regulates the manner in which personal information must be processed by the relevant institutions. So it does not deal with the classification of state information, number one. Number two, Chair, some of the conditions deal with security, but that is to keep information safe against unauthorized disclosure or access to that specific information, but that is all in the personal interest of the data subjects or the individuals. Hopefully I explained the difference between the two.
Thank you very much. You can continue. Honorable members, can we please focus on the presentation on the protection of personal information and not confuse it with the two? They are two separate bills, and can we focus on this one?
I think just to add to what Inka said, I've seen in the newspapers they've actually referred to the State Information Bill as the Secrecy Bill and this one as the Privacy Bill, and maybe that gives some sort of indication of the focus of the bill. Okay, so we've got the first misconception. It is not, it's the right to control the personal information, not the right to be left alone. Secondly, privacy is an obstacle to overcome. Some companies and government entities may see this as another obstacle that they have to deal with. However, as we will show you during the, both my own and Heng's presentations, it is actually a design objective. And what that means is it is actually, it will enhance your company or the government's own management of their records, which would actually be a good thing for the company itself. We will get to that a little bit later in the presentation as well, but I would just like to mention it immediately. And then the third misconception is that privacy protection will stem the flow of the information. That is also not true. It will only regulate the flow of the information. So you will still, there's not a single piece of legislation that is at the moment being processed that will not be processed anymore after the bill comes into place, but the way in which it is processed will be dealt with. So that is very important. Those are three very important points. Okay. What are the aims, purposes, and goals of the legislation? There are practical considerations, constitutional imperatives, and international obligations. Those are the three main reasons for the bill being enacted. But on a very practical level, one should also remember that the bill was actually the South African Law Reform Commission, when it started its investigation, that it was asked by Parliament to do so. Parliament was dealing with what used to be called the Open Democracy Bill, and the Open Democracy Bill had two parts. It had the access to information part and the protection of information part. And the access to information part became PAIA, what we know today, Promotion of Access to Information Act. But the privacy part was not well researched at that time, and they thought that it needed more work before they introduced it. So they actually divided the Open Democracy Bill, enacted the PAIA, and gave the rest to the South African Law Reform Commission to investigate and come back to Parliament. That we did. We came back to Parliament, and it was considered in Parliament, and that's why it is here now. So that is very important. It was in on the instruction of Parliament that this work was actually done. Now, let's look at, but if we look at the reason for the bill, why it is necessary at all, and why Parliament thought it necessary to investigate it, there are three issues: practical considerations, constitutional imperatives, and the international obligations of the country. Now, if you look at practical consideration, you will all know that we've had an information explosion. Whereas previously, 50 years ago, it was possible to take any information. It was based, it was written on paper. You could just put it in your drawer. You could lock your drawer. You could lock the room. room in which you put the drawer, you could lock the building, and it would be fairly safe there. And somebody would have had to break into that room to actually get hold of the information. Today, you may be sitting at the coffee shop, drinking tea, and have your laptop there, and with the mere click of a button, you will be able to send information across the whole world, stacks of information, without any trouble at all. So one can just imagine that in order to keep the same protection that information had when it was paper-based and locked in a drawer, you will need some new rules to deal with the information that is now being dealt with in terms of new technology. Otherwise, you are going to lose privacy that you used to have 50 years ago. There's also increased value of information in decision-making. Today, it's very important that the information that institutions keep about you, if you, for instance, apply for a house loan, it's very important that the information that the bank keeps of you, your income and your personal information and what everything else about you should be correct, because they are taking that information and basing their decisions on the information that you provide them or the information that they keep about you. So if that information is incorrect, the decisions that are being taken about your life is going to be incorrect as well. So that is really, we've got this enormous explosion of new technology and information, but what it has left the data subject, the person whose information is collected, is a lack of confidence that the information is being used responsibly. You don't know whether it is being used responsible because there are no rules to deal with it. The big institutions, the government institutions, all of them are using that information and there are no rules in place to deal with it. So it's important that information may be inaccurate, it may be incomplete, it may be distributed unlawfully. That would lead to identity theft and all of those kinds of things. It's being used for incompatible purposes. They collect the information for one purpose and then use it for a completely different purpose without you being able to know that that is happening. And what is the result? It undermines people's dignity, your integrity, and your independence. And that is why the protection of the information will actually encourage the free flow of information, because if you can give a person the assurance that his information is going to be kept safe, then he would easily give his information. But if he's not sure what you're going to do with that information, there's no rules in place to deal with it, he's not going to be too happy to provide you with that information. It's also the case on the internet. If you know that if you give your credit card number on the internet to pay for something, and you know that that credit card number of yours are going to be safe, you will do that. But if you're not sure whether that information is going to be safe, you're not going to give your credit card number on the internet, so you're not going to use the internet to make any sort of payment or whatever. Okay, so these are practical information. What we have to remember is that with these this cyberspace, the virtual world versus the real world, it is the same problems. You encounter the same problems that you have, and therefore it is necessary to deal with this changing landscape. Now, what's very important in the bill is that since every day new things are, 10 years ago we didn't have smartphones. In 10 years' time, who knows what will be the technology at that stage? And the bill can't be changed every 5 minutes. So it is very important that the bill should be technologically neutral. And we've tried to do that so that whichever way the technology goes, it will still be possible to keep the bill as it is at the moment. Just a few examples of threats to data subjects, things that can happen with you if the information is not protected properly. Identity theft, financial fraud, data being gathered for billing purposes, that is, for instance, with your cell phones, and then used for another purpose. Stalking of a person, corporate espionage, phishing, that is when they ask you information and you think it is your bank that's asking the information, and in the meantime it is a fraudulent company trying to get your information to use it for a completely different purpose or to defraud you. And then also things like targeted marketing and rewards programs, all of these instances where they ask you for your information, and it's not really necessary for the contract that you are, for instance, entering, but you are giving them additional information and they give you something in return. So the these are all issues that we can deal with a bit later. So that's the practical considerations. Those are the reasons why we are living in a different world, we are living in a different information society, and we have to adapt to that in order to get the same privacy protection that we used to have 50 years ago. The second imperative is that of the Constitution. The right to privacy has always been protected in the common law. However, with Section 14 of the Constitution, it made specific provision for the right to privacy to be protected. And unfortunately, the law of the elect does not provide adequate protection at the moment. Because, you know, with the common law, these things, all these new developments, all these new technologies were not known at the stage when the common law was developed, and therefore we need specific legislation to deal with this issue. Now, a very important point, and that is our international obligations, the country's international obligations. You can quite easily understand that information privacy is not a domestic policy problem. It's a worldwide expansion of telecommunications technologies. We've already said that with the click of a button, you can send everything that's on this laptop. I can send with one click to all the countries in the world. So everybody in the world has the same problem that we have, and that is why they all came together and started discussing these issues. What are we going to do with all these computers and all the information that's being sent from one country to another country without any protection at the moment? And there, it was very interesting because you had the COE Convention and EU Data Protection Directive that came from the European Union side, and you had the OECD guidelines, which was the rest of the world, where it came from a business perspective. So from the EU side, it was a human rights perspective. From the OECD side, it was an economic perspective. But they came together, and what resulted in that was eight privacy principles or conditions. And those privacy principles were agreed on. And it was really a win-win situation, because you would think that if you look at something from a human rights perspective, it would impose on the economy. But actually, it was also good for the economy, because what happened was that each country in the world started having their own little privacy legislation. And that meant that if you were a big a company like Coca-Cola or whatever, and you wanted to send information to a multiple number of countries, then you would have to have a lawyer in each country, and each country's legislation would be different, and it would actually make it very difficult for you to send the information around the world. So what they did was try to harmonize that legislation so that if you're an international company, the laws dealing with privacy would be the same in all the countries. And you need one lawyer, and you need to understand one act, and then you could send information wherever you want to, everywhere in the world. So that harmonization process came from both the EU, from the OECD, and it came together in these eight principles, which are now internationally accepted. There are also now the APEC rules. They are the Asian Pacific countries, the Commonwealth. We are part of the Commonwealth, United Nations, where we are also part of, and there are also ISO and IEC privacy frameworks. So I'm just giving you a sort of a background to show you that it is now a worldwide phenomenon, and everybody is dealing with it in the same way. There's consensus on these accepted privacy principles, although the implementation differs somewhat in specific countries. It's also interesting to note that in Africa, Henk and myself attended the AU Technical Experts Group meeting about a month ago in Addis Ababa, and they are actually developing a convention, an AU convention on cybersecurity, and half of that convention deals with this issue specifically, the protection of personal information. And they need 15 countries to sign that convention in order for it to come in place, and I think it will be possible to get those 15 countries, because we already have countries in Africa that have personal information. We are not the first in Africa. There's Senegal, Morocco, Benin, and Burkina Faso, and I think there's Mauritius as well, and Egypt, I think, also now have legislation. Of course, South Africa is now trying to get legislation as well. So I think it will be possible for them to get this convention implemented, and everybody that was there, they were representatives of all the countries, were quite positive about this development. You will just see why it's important for countries in Africa as well to become involved in this whole issue. There's just a map of the world, and all the colored pieces there are countries that already have privacy legislation. I think there are now, at last count, there are now 76 countries in the world with protection of personal information legislation, such as ours. So we will be joining the club, really. Why it is so important is really because of the transfer, trans-border transfers of the information. What happened was that, you know, these countries, the EU and the OECD, they were the sort of the start-up countries where the information, where the legislation was first introduced. Now, it was fine. They had now very strict rules as to how you were allowed to deal with the information. But because of the fact that you have computers and it's so easy to send the information to another country, what happened was that they, companies that want to, or were looking for loopholes, simply took the whole operation and just sent it via email or via the computers to a country where there was no legislation. And those countries were being called data havens. So in those countries, you could do whatever you liked with the information. Then when you're finished working with it, you just send it back to the original country. And in that sense, they were it was possible for those people who were doing this to circumvent the legislation in the countries where they actually had their companies. So they had the companies, say, for instance, in Germany, but all the admin and all the dealing with all the processing of personal information took place in another country where there were no laws. Of course, they were not happy about that, and other companies were not happy because why did they have to comply with the law if they were in Germany, but these countries who were sending the information to other countries did not have to comply with the law. So the EU directive was issued in terms of which information from an EU country is not allowed to be sent to any country that doesn't have proper protection. And also, it may not be sent from that country to another country that doesn't have adequate protection. So in that way, they actually had an impact on the whole world. Of course, they couldn't just stop having economic contact with each other. So what the interim arrangements were, and that is what we are using in South Africa as well, is that you had to, on a case-by-case basis, have a contract or a bilateral agreement or corporate rules or something dealing with this specifically, this issue specifically, every time you wanted to transfer information, and then actually indicating that you would comply with the eight privacy principles. So that is how it is working for me. But it is tiresome, and it is not the best way to deal with it. Should our country get the adequacy rating, which means that our privacy principles are in place, then the information would flow freely from one country to another, and we, will be have, we wouldn't have to have any sort of these specific contracts anymore. I think it's also just important to mention here, you know, there was a country, there was a company, Zurich Insurance, it is the UK part, actually had an operator in South Africa who operated the did the operations for them and then, you know, provided the work back after finishing. Unfortunately, in South Africa, we were not sensitized to privacy to the extent that we should have been, and the information got lost. It was actually a case where the backup tapes had been left on a car's top and the person drove away and the tapes was lost. No actual harm was done. There wasn't any proof that there was actually harm as a result of that loss. However, because of the rules in the EU being so strict, the company, the Zurich insurance, had to pay a fine. It was millions of euros of fines because they had not ensured that the contract that they had with the operator in South Africa was properly implemented and properly dealt with. Now, in South Africa, the operator did not have any responsibility in that sense because it was the original responsible party, the risk insurance, that had to pay the fines. But what was the effect for South Africa? We lost the jobs because simply they took the operator away, they took the work away from the operator, and they have not come back yet. And they will not come back before we have our position in place. So that is a way of having proper privacy legislation will be an opportunity to create jobs in South Africa, and we would be able to act as an operator, also insofar as these call centers are concerned. South Africa is a very good place in the sense that we are in the same time zone as Europe, and we are an English-speaking country, so we have a lot of opportunities here for call centers to be settled in South Africa, but not if we don't have the proper protection. So it is very important. This is just an indication of the information management life cycle. What is important is that the life cycle starts with the collection of the information. Then you can store it, you can use it, you can distribute it to other people, or you can put it in your archive, or at the end it is destructive. The life cycle starts with the collection of information that is from the person, the individual, and it only ends when you destruct the information. And for that whole process, that whole cycle, you have to do three things. You have to protect the information throughout that whole cycle so there can be no loopholes in between. Secondly, every single responsible party that deals with the information must protect the information, must take the responsibility. Now, to explain that, if you take it in the medical field, for instance, if you go to the doctor will maybe send you to a specialist. The specialist may send you to the hospital. The hospital may send you to the physiotherapist or whatever. And all of them will also deal with your medical aid fund, which will also have all your information about your illness. So there are about five institutions that will be dealing with your information in one instance. It's only you. You are one person and you are ill and you have one illness. But five different responsible parties will be dealing with it. Now, all five of them have to protect your information. It will also not be possible for the doctor to say, oh, but I gave the information to the specialist, and I can't be responsible for what the specialist does with your information. They are all responsible to you. Within themselves, they can contract between themselves, and they can try to sort it out between themselves who's now going to pay you if there's a problem. But insofar as you are concerned, all of them are responsible, and they cannot duck the responsibility by giving it to somebody else. The same will work insofar as credit reporting is concerned. If the bank, you are asking for a loan. Now the loan is contacting the credit bureau. The credit bureau is getting information from retailers, maybe more than one. There may be five or seven people there in that one transaction. They cannot send you from one place to another and say, well, it's not my responsibility, it's not my responsibility, go there, do this, do that. Every one of them is responsible. That is the way in which the ball works. So it is the whole cycle should be protected, all the responsible parties should be protected, and all eight principles. Remember we said there are eight principles that you have to comply with. Hink will be dealing with those principles in detail, explaining them to you, but all eight principles need to be protected.
Just a moment, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Maybe through you, I'm not sure whether other members would be comfortable. Just to request the presenter to speak to the content of the presentation. When we ask questions, she will be general or examples would come, because her questions are going to a caucus, say a comparison caucus.
I'm almost finished, so I will hurry up. There are just a few key aspects that are very important in terms of compliance. And that is what we have been explaining to people in workshops and so forth, is that there must be a commitment to protect the personal information of citizens or consumers. You have to have a good understanding and implementation of the PPI legislation, and then there should be a good working relationship with the information regulator. You will see those three points are actually echoing the ideas of policy, legislation, and implementation. Why is it necessary? The PPI policy decision is very important because it is common sense and it is a sound business practice. It is actually good for a company or the government to have to keep to these privacy principles because it enhances the efficiency of that company. If all your things are in order, it will be a design objective of your company to enhance the efficiency of your company. And then the three sources that you have to conduct yourself with is the PPI bill, first of all. This is the one that we are dealing with. Code of conduct, for which the PPI bill makes provision, and then also sector-specific legislation. All three of those actually form the framework, the privacy framework that the country has to comply with. So it's not only the PPI bill. You will also have to look at sector-specific legislation and also then to the codes of conduct that deals with it. Now, just a few words about the bill itself. The bill is principle-based rather than rules-based, and that means that it makes provision for an overarching framework, and it is dealing with outcomes, not process. And I just want to explain that the outcome will be completely different for a preschool teacher keeping the information of the children in that preschool than it would be for a bank keeping your financial information. But the rules are the same. So that is why we are saying the outcome is keep the information secure. But it will be different for the preschool teachers and the bank. The other thing is it is a compliance with the spirit of the law, and there's a lot of flexibility. So it is best practice approach complemented with detailed rules, codes of conduct, and the official guidance. The related legislation that I was speaking about, these are the other acts that you need to take cognizance of. It's PAIA, it's the State Information Bill, the ECT Act, the National Credit Act, the Consumer Protection Act, and the National Health Act. They are the most important ones. There may be others as well. Then the idea of working with the information regulator, it's very important to support this establishment since laws are not self-implementing and you need an authoritative champion. It also makes provision for the informal resolution of disputes, which makes it cost-effective. It also makes provision for the codes of practice that the information regulator will be able to enact with the assistance of the information regulator. And therefore, the legislation is to a large extent proactive, and it gives assistance with systemic change. So it assists people. And a lot of the work of the information regulator is also about education and information and assisting people to have that mind shift to understand what the protection of information is now about. So, in conclusion, what we must remember, the PPI Bill is a hybrid piece of legislation in that it incorporates both the human rights perspective that you get from the Constitution while providing for economic expediencies. Secondly, it is principle-based rather than rules-based, as the Bill, together with other sector-specific legislation, regulations, codes of conduct, and guidelines, form a unique privacy framework for South Africa. In getting an adequacy rating for South Africa, it will also be important to look at that whole framework, not only at the PPI Bill. The bill emphasizes the do the right thing approach and promotes compliance with the spirit of the law rather with a specific number of rules. If you have a number of rules and somebody finds a loophole, it's easy to circumvent the act. If you have to comply with the spirit of the law, with the outcome of the law, then it's more difficult because you have to get to that outcome. How you get there is more or less your own, something for yourself to decide. And then finally, just although it's possible to learn from the experiences in other jurisdictions, the bill should primarily be interpreted with reference to the international instruments from which it originated, as we referred to that previously. Thank you. The final word is this: we cannot sensibly build an information society unless the foundations and its systems are secure. And that is what we are trying to do with the bill, is to build an information society that will actually work well in practice while also protecting people whose information are being processed. Thank you very much. There are some useful websites. I don't think if this is going to be circulated to you, but these are all the commissioners in the different countries, also United States Federal Trade Commission and so forth. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think what we'll do, we'll certainly circulate this presentation for the benefit of the members. I think it provides useful background information for the bill itself. And while I'm saying that, I'm just concerned that I might forget, and this is more of a note for ourselves, but we apologize for that. We refer to PAIA as the protection of accessing would like to maybe take a brief break, or may I continue? Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chairperson, we did, the document was handed out to the committee members, and the document itself, we have actually now dealt with the first two pages of the document. Chair, if we look at the bill itself, we will find that, and I don't know whether members would like to follow with their bills as well, but we have 12 chapters in this bill which are divided into different parts as well. Chapter 1 contains two clauses dealing with the definitions and the purpose of the bill. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to go through the bill line for line. It's just, I think, an impossible task. So I will attempt to highlight the important aspects for the benefit of the committee members, which will most probably assist them to study the bill easier or with more ease. With regard to clause 1, sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. With regard to clause 1, I would like to highlight to the members the definitions of personal information, the term processing, the term record, the term responsible party, and then the term data subject. Now, we have the definition of personal information for the past 12 odd years since we have enacted the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So the definition is largely very similar to the definition that we have had in the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Once again, Chair, I'm not going to go through it line by line. I think the important thing is to note that the term personal information is defined in such a manner that it actually refers to any type of information which identifies a person as an individual XYZ. The definition is also not a closed list, so it will, of course, be expanded upon as and when necessary. And then we should also note that the definition also applies to juristic persons, and that is in view of the fact that the Constitution provides that, where applicable, the fundamental rights may also be applied to juristic persons. The term processing is once again defined to cover all the aspects of the processing of personal information, from the collection thereof right up to the destruction of the information. The term record is also very similar, nearly identical to the definition as we find it in the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The term responsible party, the important issue to identify there, Mr. Chair, is that responsible parties will be both public and private bodies. So, in a sense, like the Promotion of Access to Information Act applies to public and private bodies, this legislation will also apply in both public and private spheres. And then the definition of a data subject, if we refer to a data subject, we refer actually to a person. So it means that it's the person to whom personal information relates. Clause 2 of the bill provides us with the purpose of the legislation, primarily to protect the right to privacy with regard to the processing of personal information, Mr. Chair, but then also important to balance the right of privacy against other rights, such as the right of access to information, and then protecting important interests, including the free flow of information within the Republic and across the borders of the Republic. Mr. Chair, I'm on page 4 now of the briefing document, and I would just like to highlight to you think that we should take into consideration that the promotion of Access to Information Act already deals with one of our conditions for the past 10, 12 years, and that is the condition dealing with the collection of personal information, which we have a provision that provides in Bahia that if an institution controls personal information and it is incorrect, you have the right to request that information be corrected. So there is a strong link between the two pieces of legislation. We'll get back to that later, especially when we start talking about the information regulator. But it's important to note that the information regulator will exercise powers and functions in terms of this legislation, as well as the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Mr. Chair, Chapter 2 then deals with the, or reflect the application and interpretation provisions. And I would like to highlight clauses 4 and 5 for the benefit of the members. These clauses were included as a result of the work of the Technical Committee in the National Assembly. The Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development appointed a technical committee consisting of 3 members to consider the bill and to report back to the Portfolio Committee. And they requested us to provide or to insert these 2 provisions. Clauses 4 and 5 are actually aimed at assisting a person who reads the legislation for the first time, or in my case, for the 10th time, to understand how the different parts of the legislation flows into each other. They do not contain any substantive provisions, so they sort of provide a roadmap of what is to follow in the legislation. For example, then, Clause 4 provides us merely with an indication where we find the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information, and then it deals with different scenarios in sub-clauses 2 to 6 regarding the processing of personal information under certain circumstances and how compliance should take place with regard to the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information. Clause 5 was inserted at the request of the committee to provide an early indication to a reader of the bill what the rights of a data subject is with reference to the bill itself. Once again, you will note, Mr. Chair, that the substantive provisions for the rights are not created here. It is in the remainder of the bill, but it sort of gives us an index of the different rights as they are created in the main body of the bill. The ambit of the bill is very wide in view of the definitions of processing, in view of the definitions of responsible parties, etc. My apologies. So there is a need to have Clause 6, which deals with exclusions. Now, Mr. Chair, I think the provisions of Clause 6 are also straightforward, but it amounts to the fact that there are certain instances of the processing of personal information where the bill will not apply. For example, when personal information is processed in the course of purely personal or household activity. So in other words, an individual who processes the personal information of his or her friends, there's no need for him or her to really comply with the legislation and all the obligations imposed by Clause 6.1d, for example, in line with the Promotion of Access to Information Act, excludes processing of personal information by the Cabinet and its committees and the Executive Council of a province. And in paragraph E, also with regard to the judicial functions of a court, referred to in section 166 of the Constitution, those are duplications of the provisions of in short, what that provision provides is that type of processing will not be subject to the ambit of the bill, provided that persons who, by virtue of office employment or profession, are subject to a code of ethics that provides adequate safeguards for the protection of personal information. So that provides us with an indication that persons who, for example, are journalists by trade and they are subject to a code of ethics that provides adequate protection of personal information, they will not be subject to the provisions of the bill. Mr. Chair, I'm now going to provide you, first of all, with a broad overview of the content of Chapter 3 by indicating to you that that is insofar as the responsibilities of a responsible party is concerned, the sort of the core of the legislation for purposes of compliance. And that is that Chapter 3 consists of three parts, Part A, B, and C. Part A deals with the processing or the conditions for the processing of personal information in general, and then Part B deals with certain requirements with regard to the processing of special personal information, and then Part C deals with the processing of the personal information of children. Now, Part A, Mr. Chair, consists of eight conditions. You will remember during the introductory remarks by Ms. Lowe that she made reference to the principles for the processing of personal information and that there are eight principles. The Portfolio Committee requested that the term principle should rather be replaced with the terms condition. So, strictly speaking, when we refer to conditions in our legislation, we are actually referring to the principles as they are internationally accepted and applied. Mr. Chair, I don't know, I don't think it may be useful to once again go through each and every one of them individually. Maybe just to explain the general trend of the clauses to you, and if I could use clause 12 as an example at this stage, then on page 13 of the bill, which forms part of the second condition, which relates to processing limitation. We will note that subclause 1 provides that personal information must be collected directly from the data subject, except as otherwise provided for in subsection 2. So, strictly speaking, at first sight, one finds that the principle or the condition itself, that information must be collected directly from the data subject, there's nothing wrong with something like that, but there are exceptions to that general rule, which is necessary. And those exceptions we then find in subclause 2. So subclause 2 provides that it's not necessary to comply with subsection 1 if, for example, paragraph A, the information is contained in or derived from a public body or has deliberately been made public by the data subject. So that will entail that I, as a responsible party, subject to the condition that I must collect the personal information directly from the data subject. But if the data subject has made that information public, it's not necessary for me to approach the data subject because that information is already available. So subclause 2A to F then deals with, if I may call them, the exceptions to the rule insofar as the processing limitation is concerned with regard to condition 2. isolation, it's important that the responsible party should comply with all 8 conditions of for the processing of personal information. Then there are exceptions which I will turn to later, but I would just like to at this stage then draw your attention to part B of chapter 3, which is on page 19 of the bill, and that deals with the processing of special personal information. Now, it has been recognized that certain types of information should be recognized as what is termed here and generally in other legislation as special personal information. Special personal information, in clause 26, we find the definition in paragraphs A and B of what is regarded as special personal information. For example, a person's religious or philosophical beliefs, trade union membership, political persuasion, health or sex life, or then biometric information of a data subject. And then B, insofar as criminal behavior of a data subject is concerned, to the extent that such information relates to the alleged commission by a data subject of any offense or any proceedings in respect of any offense allegedly committed by a data subject or the disposal of such proceedings. Part B in clause 26 establishes a prohibition to the extent that clause 26 prohibits one from processing special personal information. And then in the remainder of the clauses, once again, because an outright prohibition can never be, it can never be the case. Clauses 27 to 33 then provides again the exception to the rule, or as we refer to it here in the bill, the general authorization concerning the processing of special personal information. Mr. Chair, I would like to briefly draw your attention to then clause 27. You will recall that we said that in clause 26 there is a prohibition on the processing of personal information concerning the special personal information of a person. Clause 27 then creates the general exception to the rule or general authorization by stipulating that the prohibition on the processing of personal information as referred to in section 26 does not apply if the processing is carried out with the consent of the data subject. Processing is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or an obligation in law. Processing is necessary to comply with an obligation of international public law. Paragraph D, processing is for historical, statistical, or research purposes. To the extent that the purpose serves a public interest, that the processing is necessary for the purpose concerned, or it appears to be possible, or would involve a disproportionate effort to ask for consent, and sufficient guarantees are provided for to ensure that the processing does not adversely affect the individual privacy of the data subject to a disproportionate extent. Or then in paragraph E, the information has deliberately been made public by the data subject. So up to paragraph E we have our general authorization in respect of that what appears to be an outright prohibition on the processing of personal information and special personal information. And then in paragraph F we find reference to clauses 28 to 23. So in addition to clause 27, we have more specific authorizations insofar as the individual components regarding a person's special personal information is concerned, and may use an example to provide you with a general trend then. On page 20 of the bill, clause 30, trade union membership is an aspect of a person what is defined or recognized as special personal information. And clause 30 provides us, in addition and above clause 27, which is the general authorization, that the prohibition on the processing of personal information concerning a data subject's trade union membership, as referred in section 26, does not apply to the processing by a trade union to which the data subject belongs, or to the trade union federation to which the trade union belongs, if such processing is necessary to achieve the aims of the trade union or the trade union federation. And then subclause 2, in those cases referred to in a subsection 1, personal information may not be supplied to third parties without the consent of the data subject. Mr. Chair, so that is part B insofar as the processing of special personal information of data subjects are concerned. I think the clauses speak for themselves. I don't know, and I believe that it will not be necessary once again to highlight each and every clause. I think the principle or the approach to note is that we have our general prohibition in 26, then we have a general authorization in 27, and then in individual cases with regard to the individual components of special personal information, we have those clauses dealing with those components. In part C, which consists on page 22 of two clauses, a clause 54 and a clause 55, is the prohibition on the processing of personal information of children. The South African Law Reform Commission pointed out to us that children, in view of their own vulnerabilities, should be afforded special protection in terms of this legislation. Mr. Chair, we can only, and the committee members have vast experience of this with regard to, for example, our sexual offences legislation as well, where we know that children are vulnerable, especially where they interact over the social media, internet, Twitter, Facebook, etc. This move is also something that is taking place worldwide insofar as the processing of personal information is concerned. We have had one specific challenge when the portfolio committee considered these clauses, and that was what children, what the definition of a child is. It would not have sufficed, Mr. Chair, to define a child for purposes of this legislation as a person under the age of 18 years. To provide you with an example, there are numerous pieces of legislation in our country that requires different ages for children to legally conduct different transactions. For example, a child, in order for that child to open a bank account, must be 16 years and older. So it is recognized that a child of 16 years will be competent to open a bank account on his or her own initiative. That is why we had to recognize in our definition of child that there are other pieces of legislation which provides for different ages of competency. I apologize for doing this, Chair. I need to refer you back then to page 7 of the bill. I will try not to jump too much back and forth, but we have the definition, the very second definition then in clause 1 is a child means a natural person under the age of 18 years who is not legally competent without the assistance of a competent person to take any action or decision in respect of any matter concerning him or herself. So what we have done, Mr. Chair, is to say, this definition, all that it actually says with reference to our bank example, bank accounts example, is that if you are competent to open a bank account, if you are, in other words, competent to do that transaction, perform that transaction, part of that transaction will be for you to divulge personal information about yourself. So if you are competent to transact, open the bank account, you will, for purposes of this legislation, also be regarded as being competent to provide your personal information to that responsible party. And then in that, to that extent, you will not be regarded as a child for purposes of clauses 34 and 35. So, strictly speaking, the bank will not require the consent of a competent person before the bank can conclude that transaction with the child. There's a second important definition then on page 7, and that is the definition which runs with the definition of child, and that is the definition of competent person in line 15. Competent person means any person who is legally competent to consent to any action or decision being taken in respect of any matter concerning a child. Mr. Chair, back to page 22 then, and clauses 34 and 35. We have our prohibition in clause 34, which provides that a responsible party may not process the personal information concerning a child. And then in clause 35, we have our general authorization concerning the processing of the personal information of children. Now, if we refer to children here, and if we refer to personal information, Mr. Chair, we do not refer to the special personal information which we just had a look at in paragraph, in part B of the bill. We're talking about the sum total of the information of children. So we're not only referring to a child's religious beliefs, etc. Clause 35 then provides us with the general authorization, and it provides in sub 1 that the prohibition on the processing of personal information of children, as referred to in section 34, does not apply if the processing is carried out with the prior consent of a competent person, is necessary for the establishment, exercise, or defense of a right or obligation in law, etc. And then in subclause 2, Mr. Chair, we get an indication that the role of the regulator will also be important. If a responsible party has to process the personal information of a child but cannot find him or herself under clause 35(1)(a)(2)(e), that responsible party will be able to approach the regulator with a request to be authorized to process the personal information of a child, and in subclause 3, the regulator will be able to impose reasonable conditions in respect of the authorization granted. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to interrupt myself, and I see one of my colleagues have already joined us, and I think he is scheduled to brief the committee at 12 o'clock. I promise that we will be finished before 12. I will stick to our allotted time. We are nearly halfway with the bill, and the parts that follow will be able to explain them fairly quickly to the committee. Chapter 4 then consists of 3 clauses and deals with the power of the regulator to grant exemptions. There are instances where a responsible party may not be able to comply with a specific condition, but there is justification for the responsible party, notwithstanding that, to process the personal information of a data subject. And that is where the power of general information of a data subject. Clause 37 then is actually the main clause, which gives us an indication that the regulator may grant an exemption to a responsible party if the processing is in the public interest. Subclause 2 provides us with an indication of what the term public interest includes, and then in subclause 3, the regulator will, notwithstanding the fact that it may grant an exemption, will also be imposed to impose reasonable conditions in respect of any exemption granted. Chapter 5 deals with the supervision and consists of two parts. The first part deals with the information regulator, and the second part with information officers. Part A then entail all the provisions dealing with the establishment of the information regulator. Information regulator will be an independent institution appointed by the president, Mr. Chair, and will be responsible for exercising its powers, duties and functions in terms of the PPI Bill as well as the Promotion of Access to Information Act, as we have referred to earlier. The provisions in Part A then are quite straightforward and primarily deal with the establishment of the regulator. Clause 40 is also a useful provision to take note of on page 24 and page 25, which gives us an indication of what the powers, duties and functions of the regulator are. And I would like to maybe just highlight that the regulator is going to have his plate very full, Mr. Chair, because apart from the fact that there is a huge responsibility on the regulator to provide education, education is most probably one of the most important aspects of the first phases of implementation of this legislation, or the first few years of the implementation of this legislation. The regulator will also, in paragraph E, be able to monitor and enforce compliance by public and private bodies with the provisions of the Act. At the bottom of page 24, to consult first interested parties, to handle complaints, to conduct research, and then also to issue codes of conduct. Okay, so I think in a nutshell, to get a very good idea of what the regulator will be about, one could have a look then at clause 40, which gives us an indication of its the ambit of its work. Part B on page 31 deals with information officers. We have information officers in the Promotion of Access to Information Act for public as well as private bodies. In view of the fact that there's a close link between the two pieces of legislation, it is also necessary to give a general indication of what the duties of the information officers will be in respect of the PPI Bill in clause 55 and then clause 56, as is the position in the Promotion of Access to Information Act, makes provision for the deputy information officers. Clause 6, chapter 6 on page 32 deals with prior authorization. And 57 provides us with an indication that a responsible party, if that responsible party processes personal information under specific circumstances, must receive codes of conduct is a very important aspect, Mr. Chair, and it links very close to our eight conditions for the processing of personal information, which we refer to in Chapter 3. You will also remember that during our introductory remarks, we refer to the three aspects which actually creates or establishes the framework for the protection of personal information, and that is the ability of the regulator to issue codes of conduct. One can just imagine that our eight conditions, apart from the fact that they are neutral as far as technology is concerned, as we explained, they are also very broad and general. It might be in the insurance industry or the banking sector that a need may arise for a code to be introduced, which will give a definitive indication of how the various conditions should be applied in that specific sector. So the clauses of Chapter 7, then clauses 60 to 68, deal with the power of the regulator to issue codes of conduct. In clause 60, the regulator is then empowered to issue those codes. Clause 61 deals with the process for issuing the codes of conduct. In short, if the code is approved, it will have the power of legislation and it will be published in the Gazette. The processing of the process for issuing codes will also require that interested parties are consulted during that process. Chair, I nearly said insulted. Consulted. Clause 62, notification availability and commencement of the code. I think those provisions are quite straightforward. Clause 63 is also an interesting clause and an important clause to note, and that is that those codes will provide procedures for dealing with complaints arising from the processing of personal information, which is then subject to a code of conduct. 64 provides the regulator with the power to amend or revoke codes. 65 then also deals with the regulator's ability to provide written guidelines to assist bodies to develop codes of conduct or to apply approved codes of conduct. The regulator is also required in terms of clause 66 on page 35 to keep a register of approved codes as a reference, as a source of reference, so that one could say that if the responsible party XYZ claims that it operates in terms of a code of conduct, then that information can be verified by reference to the register to be kept by the regulator. Clause 67 deals with the review of operation of approved codes of conduct, and then clause 60, the effect of the failure to comply with a code. And I would just like to quote clause 68, Chair. If a code issued under section 60 is enforced, failure to comply with a code is deemed to be a breach of the conditions for the lawful processing of personal information referred to in Chapter 3 and is dealt with in terms of Chapter 10. Now, just briefly, Mr. Chair, the Chapter 10 deals with the enforcement of the rights and especially civil liability of responsible parties. And also the ability of data subjects to submit complaints to the information regulator. As soon as there is an interference with the protection of your personal information, you will, in terms of Chapter 10, be able to lay a complaint with the information regulator or even institute civil proceedings against the
Can I just come in there? We have three more presentations before half past 12. Can you just try to summarize?
Yes, sir. I'm going to conclude now, Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair, in short, then, Chapter 8 deals with three different scenarios under which processing of personal information takes place. I think also those provisions are straightforward. Chapter 9 deals with the transborder information flows, and you will remember during our presentation, Ms. Lowe have given us a very good idea of what that provision is actually all about. Chapter 10 is the important provision insofar as the enforcement of the rights are concerned and the role that the regulator plays in the enforcement of the rights of data subjects. I would like to just maybe draw your attention then to clause 99 on page 45, civil remedies. That is, it gives us an indication that above and beyond the fact that you may submit a complaint to the information regulator, you also have the right to institute a civil claim against the responsible party. Chapter 11 deals then with offences, penalties and administrative fines. Chapter 12 deals with our general provisions, power to make regulations, the procedure to make those regulations, and then clause 114 introduces a few transitional arrangements. And then with regard to the schedule to the bill, Mr. Chair, the proposed amendments there primarily aims to introduce the information regulator in the place of the South African Human Rights Commission, the functions that they exercised in terms of PAVIA. Those were additional functions and interim measure which was implemented when PAVIA was promoted. The regulator will now take over those functions and will be responsible to enforce this bill and the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and will also have various responsibilities in terms of PAVIA, which will be included by way of the proposed amendments reflected in the schedule to the bill. Mr. Chair, allow me to conclude. We have picked up a few technical glitches here and there in the text of our bill. For example, on page 24, at the bottom of page 24, you will note that the word consult is incorrectly spelled. And we have prepared a list of those, and with your permission, we could possibly submit them to you for the members to take note of and consider as well. But as I said, those are merely technical amendments that we would like to propose to correct the text where necessary. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we still have three more presentations before we adjourn at half past 12. I would not allow members to engage with their presentation except to note it so that we allow other presentations. Those questions that you will have, you can just note them down. We'll raise them again when we meet with the department. Thank you very much. Can we now get the next presentation with regard to the proclamations?
Good morning, Chief President, members. Before we start, we were informed that we must keep it short and simple. I'm Brigadier Kubi Stradum, Legal Component Crime Operations. With me is General Motsisa Nagapi Mati, also from the same legal component. And she's going to do it in 5 minutes. If she does it in more than five, then you know what's going to happen. It's police.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. My presentation is going to be very short. And I was happy when I was told that it's going to be, I must be, meet it in 5 minutes. When I look at the time, I was scared and said, my presentation is not that long. How am I going to make it stretch to an hour? Our presentation was, we made it in connection with a request that we received from the Select Committee. We have, I have made a little information on the proclamations that the request was made, which is proclamation. Resolution 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, and 47. In Proclamation 41 that was dated 20 July 2011, the committee delisted two names at the request of the Ombudsman. I will explain later what the Ombudsman is all about. And on Proclamation 42 dated 20 July also, it was a delisting of two names. Proclamation 43, they amended name of one individual. Proclamation 45, 9 June, two names were delisted of individuals. 9 June, they amended nine names of individuals. 15 June, addition of two names of individuals. And 22nd June, they delisted two names of individual and one entity. Proclamation 47 is the most important proclamation, because this proclamation, before Proclamation 47, individuals and entities dealing with Taliban and Al-Qaeda, they were under one list. But in this proclamation, after the 15th of June 2011, the United Nations Security Council decided to make two listings. They distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Taliban. So Al-Qaeda is a consolidated list under Proclamation 1988 of 2011. It deals only with Taliban individuals and Taliban entities. And 1267 of 1999 deals with Al-Qaeda individuals and Al-Qaeda entities. South African government is a member of the United Nations, and this is a request under Article 25 of the United Charter that members of the United Nations agreed to accept and carry out the decision of the Security Council in accordance with the present charter, which is the 1948 charter of the United Nations. Our constitution in section 231 included this request from the United Nations. And we enacted Act, the protection of, I'm sorry, under section 25 of the POCTATORA, the protection of constitution against democracy, against terrorist activities. We give all the notification of proclamation of any individual or entity who is involved in terrorist activities. And section 26 of the same act says every proclamation issued under this section 25 shall be tabled in Parliament for its consideration and decision, and Parliament must thereupon take such steps as it may consider necessary. The proclamation is. So, I'm going to jump most of the pages. Check it out. That is there. I don't know if you want to know what is the procedure that is done by the United Security Council when they do the listing of an individual. You don't want to know that. You want to know anything about the delisting?
No.
The reasons for listing?
No, we are aware of that.
Reasons for listing?
No.
Then I am done if you don't want to know.
Okay.
The only reason is storytelling.
benevolence on that paper.
And unfortunately, we don't have any South African listed on that as of now.
No, thank you very much. Honorable members, we also note the presentation.
Chairperson, may we please then be excused?
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, you are.
To put the background, but I'm sure the department and so on would be able to give you more
detail around the actual amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is it not us that we wait for the department to present and then we will... Yes.
Section 74 that deals with NA and NCOP in terms of must approve. What is the other one that NCOP alone is at 174, 3 or 5? Or what is a specific one said that we must debate.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Member, the provisions I'm referring to is Section 74.3b. If you look at 74.3b, those are the constitutional amendments that actually they require a supporting vote of at least 6 provinces if the amendment relates to some of those matters. But this particular amendment has not been classified as one of those. So you have to read a little bit further down to Section 74.5c, where it actually says, if I could just paraphrase, that the NCOP, in other words, this is now the minister, submits in accordance with rules and orders those particulars to the council for a public debate if the proposed amendment is not an amendment that is required to be passed by the council. So that's where the distinction comes in. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. So with other words, here is party political views and debate. It's not about province. Then it's clarity that you know, Chair, Louis is having a very serious.
You are protected.
Thank you very much.
Protected.
I am asking clarity.
I'm not from you myself.
You are both protected.
Thank you very much. No, that was my question.
Yes. Can you clarify to
Honourable? Thank you, Chairperson. Again, if I reiterate, there is no vote on the bill, so it's not either regarded as a 76 or 74 or 77 or 75 in terms of voting. But I do just want to maybe indicate to members that in terms of Section 74.5, where these particulars actually, could I say, also emanate from, is that firstly the minister has to provide these particulars to the National Assembly, and then also the National Assembly has to also get particulars from provincial legislatures. So I'm not saying to members it's either one or the other, but just to contextualize that there is also within the Constitution, and I don't know if the department would maybe want to elaborate on whether there's indeed been specific ones that have come from provincial legislatures, but the submissions cut across both the National Assembly, the provincial legislatures, and the National Council of Provinces. And as I said, because there's no vote, honourable members, how you approach the debate would probably be guided by what you see in these particulars. Thank you very much.
You can continue.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just for those members who are not familiar with myself, I'm the underlinger of the department, but I are familiar with the fact. And then just to thank the member of the staff, she's done half of what I was intending to inform the committee already, Chair. And then I have good news and some more good news. First part is rather very brief, and the second part is I don't think this is a particularly complicated matter that we're dealing with. The bill that was originally published for comment and submitted to the NCLP and to the various provincial legislatures, that happened in 2010, about midway through 2010, and it was eventually introduced into Parliament. It is now the Constitution 17th Amendment Bill of 2011. It deals only with five particular areas. Firstly, it amends the Constitution to put the position clear that the Chief Justice is the head of the judiciary, and as such is the leader of judiciary. The gap that the bill tries to fill there is that at the moment we've got a void. We've got the independent judiciary, but especially when it comes to the lower courts, there's no real management, judicial management. Clearly, Parliament cannot manage the judiciary. Even more clearly, the executive to the departments cannot do that. And so it belongs with the Chief Justice. And all the Constitution does, or the amendment does, it says the Chief Justice is the leader of judiciary and exercises responsibility for the judicial functions of the judiciary. That's not a very major thing, although it is a major thing. Sorry for the contradiction. Then, secondly, it provides for a single High Court of South Africa. That is more related to the Superior Court's bill that was introduced simultaneously with this constitution amendment. And the Superior Court's bill, of course, will in due course find its way to this committee, to be considered by this committee as well. But it's a much more comprehensive piece of legislation, and it deals with a rationalisation of all the other acts. Just for members' interest, I can just maybe mention that, you know, that the Superior Courts, the High Courts, in, for example, Siskai or Bishu and Mtata, you know that they still function in terms of the legislation of those old TDVC states. So that will be addressed by the Superior Courts. Well, that is just as a matter of interest I'm raising that. But there is a relationship between the constitutional amendments, because that is actually the empowering provisions that allows Parliament to roll out and to implement a comprehensive Superior Court's bill. Then it changes the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court to make it the apex court of the country. At the moment, the Constitutional Court's jurisdiction is confined to constitutional matters and issues connected to constitutional matters. It is one of the major amendments in the bill. A very brief background to that is that the way that the jurisprudence of the Constitutional Court has developed is that they have interpreted quite correctly, in my respectful view, that all law in South Africa is derived from the Constitution. It is a supreme law, and because it recognizes the common law or other law, it is very hard to say that a matter is not related to a constitutional matter. And to put the record straight, the provision is being made that that court can not only deal with constitutional issues, but also with any other issues when it grants leave to appeal a matter to the Constitutional Court. That has resulted in a certain further consequential amendments to, when it comes to the Supreme Court of Appeal. The bill addresses that as well. And in fact, it has been developed further since introduction. The committee is looking at further amendments there, but I don't think I need to annoy members with the details of something that is not presently before them. Then it also makes provision for the appointment of an acting Deputy Chief Justice. Interesting enough, why an acting Deputy Chief Justice, not an acting Chief Justice? Because once all this legislation is in place, the Deputy Chief Justice will always step into the shoes of the Chief Justice if the Chief Justice is for some other reason incapacitated or absent to fulfill his or her duties. And that's why it's important to have a provision that you can actually appoint a Deputy Chief Justice. Chair, just another point of interest that I may want to raise. The particulars that were published, the particular amendments, the proposals that were published, included an amendment to Section 178, I think, of the Constitution that related to the term of office of Constitutional Court judges. But based on the comments that we received, that was not part of the bill that was eventually introduced, so members need not be concerned about that at all. Chair, and then I've brought copies of this, not to annoy members, but to make interesting reading material. This is the summary that the department did of all the comments that we received. I must warn members, it also deals with the comments that were submitted on superior courts. That is not relevant at this stage. It will become relevant later for the members. Thanks very much. And I'm really distributing it just as a matter of interest. It's not necessary for you to read it or study it, but it makes interesting reading material. And in particular, part B, and again, it's not a very, very long part. It will see it's only two or three pages. Part B is just a summary of all the submissions that were received on the bill that we published at the time for public information. And lastly, just to reflect here on the fact that those same particulars were submitted to all the provincial received an input from the Gauteng legislature and one from the Northern Cape legislature. Northern Cape simply indicated that they did not have anything to say. Gauteng, in their submission, raised a concern. The exact wording was the committee registers its reservations about extending the scope of the Constitutional Court to be at the apex of all matters. As an appellate court on all matters, the committee is, however, of the overall view that the bill is consistent with the Constitution and international best practice. And just here, of course, we've got the benefit now of hindsight. It has been introduced in 2011, and there's been considerable debate and discussions on this already in the Portfolio Committee on Justice, who, as we are sitting here, are also looking at this matter. They may even come very, very close to concluding the matter in the committee by today or by the end of the week at least. But this has been one of the main focal points of that bill, the issue of the Constitutional Court being the apex court or not. At the moment, it looks as if the committee is going to retain that provision as is. In other words, that court is going to become the apex court, but that has been a subject of quite extensive deliberations, Chair. Chair, that is briefly my story, but I'd be happy to assist with any questions that may be raised, Chair.
No? Chairperson, two questions. I know that we are not going to finalize this, but it's clarity that I need. The last issue of the Constitutional Court, Apex Court and whatever, can you explain to me? The reason why I'm asking, do you want to bring the Constitutional Court on the same level as High Court around the country, on the same level? Or is it, you see, for now, the Constitutional Court is dealing with things that was already in courts. I need that clarity. The second one is on this issue of Deputy Chief Justice. Now we are having, I don't understand, because we are having Mokgweng and Musenege as Chief Justice and Deputy. So I don't understand that issue. What is this? Thanks, Chair.
Commissioner. Thank you, Chairperson. But what I would like to know, what prompted this? I mean, what was the problem with that section which led to this present amendment?
Honorable Joseph.
The speech that I will deliver tomorrow, I've read about the Mabantla administration, Mbeki have introduced it. So I want to know if what you're proposing now, is that what the judiciary and the Justice Department couldn't agree on? Is that what you are resolving now, or is it something new? And if there were issues that were unresolved when President Mbeki introduced it, was that issue resolved? Is that now part of the agreement that we can move forward? Thanks.
Just to try and find out, our own experience in dealing with these different courts, I mean, if you go to the lower courts, there are serious problems, and each and every area has got its own boss. Is this amendment going to solve that particular problem? Because I've indicated, in as far as the
NHOP is required to debate. Just that. Debate. If not debate, what will be the implication? Assuming there will be no debate, what will be the implication? If there is debate, fine, what will be the implication? The bill will still be amended by LA with or without a debate of the NHOP. I just want to know that.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start with the last question first, with your leave, Chair. Yes, the debate in the NCRP is a procedural requirement of the Constitution. If it does not take place, I am not too sure whether there would be any consequence. One, I suppose, could legally argue that everything has been done. It has been submitted. It has been submitted to the Chair for a public debate. If the debate doesn't take place, I suppose it's a 50-50 question whether all the procedural requirements would have been met. But ideally, one would want the debate to take place, and ideally, obviously, also the House, considering it, the NA, to take note of what was said in any sentence that we will have to convey to them in that particular debate. Then, I'm sorry, I'm tackling this in reverse order, Chair, whether the amendment is going to solve lower court problems. Just as a very personal remark, I'm not speaking for the department. My experience has been that you can hardly ever solve the problem fully through legislation. It can be a means to address some of the challenges. And what we envisage here is that we will again be giving or establishing a means through which the challenges could be addressed. I've referred earlier to the fact that there is a gap when it comes to judicial management. The Honourable Member referred to what's happening in the regional court, in the particular regional court. Now, this is again where the superior courts will kick in. There's a link between the power, the authority, not the power, that we're giving the Chief Justice as the head of the judiciary, and then what is contained further in superior courts. Part of that authority will go down through the various heads of court, of the higher courts, superior courts firstly, and then down to the magistrates' courts. For example, the Chief Justice, head of the judicial authority, then there will be the president of the SCA, the judges president of the high courts, and we've got regional court presidents and lower courts, and we've also got magistrates and chief magistrates in the other magistrates' courts. But the judge presidents of the high courts would also have a responsibility over the lower courts. So we're establishing that chain of authority, and viewed in that light, I can answer yes, we hope that we will solve some of the challenges presently confronting the magistrates' court. The important thing here is just to remember that it is something that can be done only in the judicial line of authority. Not the department and not parliament even can interfere with judicial management of courts. And that's why this amendment is seen as a very important amendment. Chair, the judiciary, whether they are satisfied, yes. We had a colloquium, members will recall, in 2005 under Minister Mbandla. It was held at Kempton Park. At the time, there were some tensions. Some of the proposals turned out to be controversial, but I'm quite pleased to report that there's nothing controversial in the bills before us, other than, of course, the academic debates. It will always be an academic debate around should it be an apex court or not. What exactly should the jurisdiction and status of the Supreme Court of Appeal be? That we cannot solve. That there will always be debates around that. But the controversial issues at the time related to judicial management, firstly, and also to accusations, and I'm not going to discuss the merit of that, but there were accusations that Parliament and the Department were looking at ways of interfering in the administration of the courts, and that is seen as a judicial function. The debate has not been settled, but all the controversial provisions were removed. It's not part of either this bill or the Superior Court's bill. In fact, this bill, in its earlier version that was at the colloquium in 2005, had two provisions when it came to judicial management. The first one was that the Chief Justice is the head of the judiciary, and the second would have been an introduction that say the Minister of Justice is responsible for the administration of the courts. That was very controversial. It's not part of the bill that was introduced. So in that respect, I can confidently state yes, decision would be in this Constitution Amendment Bill, but the rest of it will all be taken care of in the Superior Court's Bill. The issue of the Deputy Chief Justice, yes, interestingly enough, when it comes to the appointment of acting judges, the Constitution as it stands at the moment makes provision for appointment of an acting judge of the Constitutional Court if there's a vacancy or if a judge is absent. There's been always a question, but a judge of the Constitutional Court has to be distinguished from the Chief Justice. And ironically, I don't think there's provision for the appointment of an acting Chief Justice at this point in time. Neither is there a provision specifically for the appointment of an acting Deputy Chief Justice. But in the scheme of things, also read with superior courts, what will happen is your Deputy Chief Justice would always, as I've explained, automatically step into the shoes of the Chief Justice if the Chief Justice is for some or other reason absent or not available. So the real important person then to be appointed in an acting position at the Constitutional Court would be that Deputy Chief Justice, because you will always have a Deputy Chief Justice who will fill the shoes of the Chief Justice. And that's why we're making provision that there is an acting appointment of Deputy Chief Justice if there's a vacation in that position, and that person would then automatically step up if it is required. And one of the qualifications, and it's not presently in, or it's not in the bill that was originally advertised, but we've elaborated on that, just to make sure that the acting Deputy Chief Justice would always have to be one of the permanent judges of the Constitutional Court. In other words, you cannot take any person from outside the courts or even from another court and make that person acting Deputy Chief Justice. So that is just briefly on that, Chair. And then lastly, the issue of the CC being the apex court.
Just a moment, Mr. Nathan. After it's completed.
Okay.
Continue.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the apex court has been one of the issues that's been really debated. The judges, and in fact yesterday there were two judges of the SCA in the portfolio committee dealing with another subject, but they made the remarks that even though the constitutional court's jurisdiction is constitutional matters and matters connected with constitutional matters, they have already in their jurisprudence elaborated that to a stage where you can basically argue that anything in law is related to the Constitution, because all law is derived from the Constitution. As a result of that, a kind of a fiction developed in our jurisprudence about constitutional matters and non-constitutional matters. And this would address that fiction to say that, but you cannot really make a clear distinction, and all cases should eventually, potentially, be able to end up in the Constitutional Court. Of course, you will have a filtering mechanism. You cannot flood the Constitutional Court with cases. So the bill also gives the Constitutional Court quite a distinct discretion as to decide, look, I'm not going to take all matters, especially if it's gone through various tiers of courts. They would be very loath to take anything from the Supreme Court of Appeal, for example, because there's already been various stages of appeal. But the test will be applied that if it's really, and in fact they are changing the wording, as we said here, at this stage they will have to be convinced that there's an arguable point of law of general public importance that must be decided by the Constitutional Court, and only then it will be allowed by. But the decision would lie with the Constitutional Court itself.
Honourable Bloom, Honourable Mkhobi and Commissioner.
The reason why I'm asking, I'm going to follow up on the status of the are you tampering with the status of the Constitutional Court or no? Because it will be a worrying something if the status and the powers of the Constitution, you know, presently everybody in South Africa, when he or she is not happy, will know at least we are having a place where we can go to. That is the first one. The second one is, I am not convinced about the appointment of a deputy Chief Justice. You try to explain it. But I'm saying, at present, there is already such a move. Why change the constitution? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make the follow-up on the question I raised. Precisely because it's just a festival of ideas here. This amendment has got no indication of impact on any person. Look at the parliament is defined as SNA and NSOP. Is it a parliament?
NSOP and National Assembly.
Correct. Because I have suspicion that this procedure requirement that we have been clarified for is an obligation of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It's an obligation. And therefore the debate is not just a debate. We are meeting a particular procedure requirement. I'm suspecting if whoever is accessing to the law will ask a question and say, did you meet the requirement? But there's no SOP debate. It simply means that the requirement is not met. It's an obligation. The issue is the very same obligation. Whatever expressions that are legal good, constitutional good, historical good, whatever, it's just to me. I don't want to use this negative waste of time on it. But to me, I would want to say it requires everything by the department to say the very same section 5 that you read. I think the department must go and make everything so that. Because this is about constitutional matter, it's not a regulation. Whatever. It's a constitutional matter so that when a parliament debate is a complete parliament, is NA and NSOP debating, whether it's section 75, whatever, we shall have done what we do with other legislation. And to me it will give more weight and it will also make us to research more when we go to talk to public. But to go there, we can go and say what we want. That's my view. How to say that the department, they'll go and the amendment in 26 to amend, they should amend the very same thing.
Commissioner, Honorable Bloom want to make a follow-up on that. Will be the last one.
What value will it add for us to debate tomorrow? The thing that Mokobi is asking. Are we going to change anything?
Commissioner?
Chairperson, you'll close me because I had the same question. But all right, let me come here. Explanation said if they want to appoint an acting deputy what?
Chief
Justice. It must be in the line of those group there. Is the person who is going to appoint is allowed to maneuver and sometimes, let's say, I'm not going to give the names here. Let's say we're having the first one and second now, presently, in our government. Will the person who is going to appoint, is it the appointment if the Chief Justice is not sometimes is ill? It's not in the office. Will the person is going to appoint try to maneuver and then leave the second one which follows that one and appoint the next one or the third one? I don't know what to make it names.
It's unfortunate I've not gone through this particular amendment. But who appoints them?
Yeah.
Who appoints the acting chief justice? Who appoints? There will be a problem somewhere. Because I know in terms of appointing judges, it is the JSC. Now in terms of this, who appoints?
Honourable members, you are now fired up and we are running out of time. When you hope there won't be other questions after the response. Can you also maybe shed light on the debate regarding the status of the Supreme Court of Appeal?
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll be as brief as possible. I'm starting from the top this time. The status of the Constitutional Court. What this bill is doing is actually enhancing the status. It's becoming truly the apex court, the highest court in the country, by extending its jurisdiction in very clear, unequivocal terms. It can deal with any matter. At the moment, it's theoretically limited to constitutional matters and issues related thereto. Once this is passed, it can deal with any matter that it decides to do. Then the acting, yes, I maybe might not have made myself very clear, Chair. This position of the acting Deputy Chief Justice, it doesn't affect the position that it is, for example, of Deputy Chief Justice Lekang Mosoneke. The problem would arise, let me just very briefly explain to you, Section 175.1 of the Constitution, when it comes to, it deals with acting judges, and it says the President may appoint a woman or a man to be an acting judge of the Constitutional Court if there is a vacancy or if a judge is absent. The appointment must be made on the recommendation of the cabinet member responsible for justice, that is the Minister of Justice, acting with the concurrence of the Chief Justice. That's why I said earlier there's already a problem. If you appoint an acting judge to the Constitutional Court with the concurrence of the Chief Justice and you do not have a Chief Justice, you already have a problem. Now, how we solve that problem is in Superior Court's bill by saying that your Deputy Chief Justice and also the Deputy President of the SCA would always step into the shoes of the Chief Justice or the President of the SCA. That's why it becomes important that you need a provision in terms of which you can appoint an acting Deputy Chief Justice. So in the event that Justice Mosoneke is, for example, absent, he would need somebody in his place to take over the role of the Chief Justice if the Chief Justice suddenly pass away or be absent or be incapable to deal with it. And I think I've already given the answer. The Constitution says it is the President acting with on the recommendation of the Minister of Justice and with the concurrence of the Chief Justice. Obviously, if the Chief Justice is available. Then, Chair, the issue of the debate. Yes, I don't think it's for the department really to say too much about that. I can remark that it has been reflected on also in the Portfolio Committee that it's not often, I think this happened once before, where we've had this kind of debate in the National Council of Provinces. And I really think that, and it's not for me or for us to suggest how people should go about working, but this is an area I think that needs to be explored a bit. To determine exactly what the framers of the Constitution had in mind. If there is a gap here, then maybe one should look at it again, because you want a role, and you want a significant role. It shouldn't be just going through the motions, which is always the danger when doing things like this. But as I said earlier, ideally I would have supposed that ANA would take cognizance of everything that was said in this debate, but that is where it stops, and I think there is room for development. Maybe looking at time frames, how we deal with those things. But as I say it with great reservation. It's not for me. I can make suggestions, but I can really not even hint at you at how you should go about it.
Thank you.
Last question, maybe from my side. What was the response from the legal fraternity? And of course, we are making laws on behalf of the public. Was there any public participation, and what was the response on that? So that will inform us how to steer a debate or influence a decision in the debate that must still be taken in Parliament.
So yes, you'll find it summarised very nicely. It's summarised there, and of course, one of the reasons, as I said earlier, we had a provision that would extend the terms of office of the of the judges of the Constitutional Court to tenure like all the other judges. And as a result of public response, that was specifically dropped. And then thereafter, of course, there was a very comprehensive process. There were a process of post-introduction, very, very comprehensive process.
I just wanted to make one small point, if you just allow me.
again to assure the committee that from the Office of the Secretary to the NCOP, we have specifically engaged with the Office of the Chairperson of the NCOP around the issue around having the debate, and that it is, as the gentleman from the department said, it is a constitutional requirement. And so we were obviously aware of leaving any possibilities for challenging on a procedural ground. And so we really wanted to close all of those doors. Also, the rules of the NCOP sort of echo what is in the Constitution and also talk about the debate that is required. So there were sort of two sources of authority that we specifically had to look at and make sure that we could advise accordingly. Thank you.
So my philosophy is legal. thank you very much, Honorable Member. That then brings us to...
It's the President. The President, on the advice of the Minister of Justice, and in the case of ordinary judges of the Constitutional Court, it must do it in concurrence with the Chief Justice. If it's not the Chief Justice... Yes. From the Constitutional Court itself, yes. Not from outside the Constitutional Court.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.